Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. We are online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and check out our YouTube channel. This program is part of our Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Becky Worley, tech contributor for the ABC News program Good Morning America, and your moderator for today's program. This evening, we're honored to be joined by prolific science writer Dava Sobel. Inspired as a student at the legendary Bronx High School of Science, Ms. Sobel went on to make a career writing about exploring such varied disciplines as astronomy, veterinary medicine, and psychiatry for the New York Times, Harvard Magazine, Audubon, Discover, Life, Omni, and The New Yorker, among others. Not only have her best-selling books, Galileo's Daughter and Longitude, been made into Nova television documentaries and an A&E made-for-TV movie, but the asteroid 30935 Dava Sobel was named after her. This stellar writer joins us today to speak about her latest book, The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. Sobel's writing weaves excerpts from letters, diaries, and memoirs to reveal the hidden history of these remarkable women's landmark contributions to astronomy in the mid-19th century. Welcome, Dava Sobel, to San Francisco.
Thank you. So we are having a little technical problem already because you are seeing my screensaver and not my... There we go. Okay. Although this screensaver is pretty good and it's the same thing. That was inspirational. So, welcome everybody. Of course, I'm thrilled to be here telling you about my Harvard ladies. The women in this cover picture are not the ladies in the story, but they are all important in their own right. And the one you see over the word glass is Wendy Friedman, who was the first person who mentioned the name Henrietta Leavitt to me about 20 years ago. In an interview. And when I went to learn more about Miss Leavitt, I discovered that she was working in a room full of women at Harvard, which was a big surprise. Didn't really associate Harvard with roomfuls of women doing science. So that was interesting. And I have pursued that story. So here's a picture of the early ladies working. When women first started at the observatory, they were called computers. There were always computers at observatories doing the math, whatever math needed to be done. Often they were men. But at Harvard, the resident astronomers just roped in their daughters, sisters, wives, taught them how to do what needed to be done, and they were part of the enterprise. And the kinds of calculations they did at the beginning really involved mapping the stars. So people were observing the stars through the distortion of the Earth's atmosphere and with the having to take into account the motion of the Earth. So those were the kind of corrections that had to be calculated into the observations. But when Edward Pickering took over the observatory in 1877, he wanted to do different kinds of things. He was a physicist, and he was really interested in the physics of the stars, because at the time, nobody knew what the stars were made of. Nobody knew why some were brighter than others. No one knew how far away they were. These were all open questions, and it's lovely to think how few decades it took to answer all those questions. So he had been teaching at MIT, where he set up a laboratory where students could learn to do experiments themselves and figure out laws of physics for themselves from these experiments. And this is a picture of the Harvard Observatory as it looked when he took it over. So it had two domes, two telescopes. The big one in the middle was for the main telescope, which was a gift from the people of Boston. And then there was also a part of the building with smokestacks. That was really the director's residence. And the big telescope is still there. It's not too useful now in the midst of light-polluted Cambridge, but it is still there. And Pickering immediately started using it for his program of photometry, figuring out the different brightnesses of the stars. And he had to build his own devices, his own equipment, and that was exciting for him. And he was also very interested in photography. And he knew this couple. This is Dr. Henry Draper and his wife, Anna Palmer Draper. And because they were independent amateurs, they could do whatever they wanted. And they were really at the forefront of astronomy because they had freedom and they had money. She was an heiress and was willing to support his work. And he was interested in bringing the new capability in photography to astronomy. This was a pivotal moment. And some astronomers didn't like the idea that a picture would replace the experienced eye. But Pickering knew it was the future, and he was very excited about it. And what the Drapers were doing was putting a prism in front of the telescope so that the light of the stars, instead of appearing as a dot on the photographic plate, would be spread out into a spectrum. And he was the only person who had succeeded in photographing stellar spectra at that time. So this is an image of a textbook rainbow pattern of a spectrum with dark lines scattered along it. This is what you usually see in a physics textbook. But at this time, the photography was not color photography. So the patterns were all shades of varying shades of gray to black. And on the photographic plates that the women were given, the spectra were little tiny smears that you could hardly distinguish one from the other. And that was the job Pickering gave some of these women. Look at this plate full of all these tiny little smears and try to make sense of the patterns. Try to sort them into categories just based on what you see. Even though we have no idea what the patterns might signify, we have to start somewhere. And the black spot on this plate is a penny, just for size. So the Drapers, having set up their lives to do this work, all of a sudden, at age 45, Henry Draper got sick and died. And his wife was devastated, naturally. She tried to carry on the work herself. That was her dream. She thought if she got some really good assistance, she could make that happen. But she really couldn't find the people who could replace her husband. So she had the thought to just give her money to Pickering at Harvard and have him do the work. And all she asked in return was that he name it the Henry Draper Memorial. So that way her husband's tie to the work would be commemorated. And so now Pickering had this influx of money. She gave him the equivalent of the entire annual operating budget every year. So he could hire more people to look at the plates and now not just be computers, but actually make discoveries by looking at the photographic plates. Because the director felt that a person looking at one of these plates with a magnifying glass could see more than the most powerful telescope could see in the sky. Because the photographic plate absorbed light over time, and it could accumulate as the human eye cannot do. So stars that had never been seen before were showing up on these plates. One of the women was Wilhelmina Fleming. She was a Scottish immigrant, and she came to work at the observatory in desperate straits. Her husband had disappeared from her life. She was pregnant. She took a job in the residence as a maid, but Pickering recognized how intelligent she was, and he moved her over to the observatory side and put her to work there. And she went home to Scotland to have her baby, but he promised her a job if she'd come back. And she did. And she did the first Henry Draper catalog, where she analyzed 10,000 stars from those little tiny spectra. And she was the first woman to hold a university title at Harvard. She was the curator of astronomical photographs. So the formidable lady in this photograph standing next to the telescope is Mariah Mitchell, the first American woman who became famous as an astronomer because she discovered a comet. And when Matthew Vassar founded Vassar College, he invited her to come and teach astronomy. So the young woman in the picture, Antonia Mori, was a niece of Henry Draper and a graduate of Vassar College when she went to work at the Harvard Observatory. She'd had 8 semesters of astronomy with Mariah Mitchell. So she brought her own insight to this classification work and came up with a completely different idea from what Mrs. Fleming had done. Much more detailed and much more complicated. So it took a third woman, Annie Jump Cannon, to look at these two systems and create a middle ground that was so successful as the classification system that it is still in use today. And I'm showing here, in addition to a photograph of Miss Cannon, a painting of her at the telescope. Because when she came to the observatory in 1896, she was immediately allowed to make her own telescope observations, whereas the others had just been looking at photographs. But she did both because she had so much experience at Wellesley College that she was qualified to do that. And the painting is from a children's book about her called Annie Jump Cannon Astronomer by Carol Gerber. And the illustrations are by Christina Wald. So here is a plate, a typical plate that Miss Cannon would have used with easily 1,000 tiny smears on it, lots of numbers being written down so she could call out a number to an assistant working with her in the computing room, and then make a judgment about what type of star that was. Not for everybody, this kind of work. One of my worries in approaching this project was being able to distinguish among the women and make the different characters come alive, so it didn't just sound like a room full of nerds. And to my great delight, all of Miss Cannon's diaries were still stored in the Harvard archives. And it's a great way to get to know somebody, to read a lifetime's worth of diaries. And I did master her terrible handwriting after not too long. And she kept it up till just a few weeks before she died. And one of the things Pickering had to do to make a photographic record of the full sky, which was his intent, was to send a deputy to the Southern Hemisphere to find a place where pictures could be taken of the southern stars. And that was Solon Bailey. And first they set up a very rudimentary shacks, really, on a place they called Mount Harvard, which wasn't really ideal. It took a long time to find a place that was at a high elevation and far from light pollution and where the weather was nice and dry. But they did find a spot near the town of Arequipa, and it was in the lee of a dormant volcano. Later on, it turned out the volcano wasn't as dormant as they thought. And for the Southern Hemisphere, where the skies were really dark, Pickering wanted a new telescope with a giant lens. And so he announced that he would need that. And another heiress, Catherine Wolfe Bruce, came forward and wrote him a check for $50,000 to build a new kind of telescope specifically for taking photographs. And life wasn't all bad in Peru. Sometimes they had picnics. And Bailey, going down there knowing he'd be there for years, took his wife, Ruth Poulter Bailey, who is the lady closest to me, and their three-year-old son, Irving. And his wife actually helped him with the observations. She did a lot of the meteorology studies, and she also helped him study objects called globular clusters. And here's a picture, and sure enough, it looks like a big glob of stars. Astronomers are very good at naming things graphically. Big bang, black hole, globular cluster. You don't have to wonder what they're talking about. You know, it's just very clear. So here is a globular cluster. These were fascinating to Bailey, especially because there were many stars that varied over time, and that's what he was looking for. He needed to count all the stars, and then he needed to follow up and see which ones were changing over time. And she, his wife, helped him with that. They would make a grid on a sheet of glass. The glass plates from that telescope were very large, 11 inches by 17 inches. And so they would make a glass piece of graph paper and put it over the photograph and then use the little boxes to try to count all the stars. And there are thousands and thousands of stars in each image. Again, this work took tremendous patience. And Henrietta Leavitt, the first name I learned of the Harvard ladies, she was given photographs taken in the Southern Hemisphere, and she was hunting for variable stars, and she was watching them very carefully. And she made a discovery that made it possible to measure distances in space at a great remove. Up until this point, stars fairly close to the sun were the only ones whose distances could be determined. But she noticed, she was looking at this object. This is it's called the Small Magellanic Cloud, because Magellan noticed this on his round-the-world voyage. He noticed there were two cloud-like objects. So in this plate, which is a negative, the cloud looks like a mass of black stars on a white background. And to one side, there's also a globular cluster of stars. So she figured all the stars in this cloud were roughly the same distance from Earth. So the ones that were brighter, the ones that looked brighter, really were brighter. And she noticed that their periods of variation were the longest. So from that became possible to tie a time period to a particular brightness. And so if you saw another variable star of that variety with that same time period elsewhere in the sky and it looked a lot dimmer, you could calculate how much farther away it was. And one of the first results that came from her finding was the distance to this Small Magellanic Cloud. And Harlow Shapley, who took over at Harvard after Edward Pickering died, used Miss Leavitt's discovery to figure out the size of the Milky Way galaxy. And it was so big that he thought it must fill the entire universe. There couldn't be anything else in the universe. Later, Edwin Hubble would use Miss Leavitt's stars to show that indeed there were other galaxies, and not only that, the galaxies were moving apart from each other. All of those discoveries were based on her finding. So Shapley really loved the idea. When he gauged the size of the Milky Way, he realized that the sun was not at the center, that it was way off center. And he loved breaking people's ideas of specialness and said, you know, this proves that man is not such a big chicken, that we're really just peripheral. And Shapley wasn't really interested in chickens, but he was very interested in ants. And this is a cartoon of two ants looking up at the night sky. And Shapley was scientifically interested in ants. He got interested in them while he was an astronomer at Mount Wilson, and he wrote several scientific papers in the course of his career about ant behavior. And so this cartoon, since the caption is missing, it's like one of those New Yorker contests now. But I'm going to tell you what the caption is. The caption is, kind of makes you feel small, doesn't it? So Shapley's vision was to create a graduate astronomy program, graduate education in astronomy. And I'm showing photos now of some of the first graduate students. They were all women, because the only fellowship money he had to bring in young people was money from another heiress to set up fellowships for young women to study at Harvard for a year or so and then go on to work at another observatory. And that was the only money he had to bring in graduate students. So Harvard's first PhD in astronomy was awarded to the woman in the lower picture. That's Cecilia Payne, later Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin. And in the course of doing her doctoral research, she noticed, by this point, the classification of the stars turned out all those categories signified different temperatures. And then she was looking at the relative abundance of different elements in the stars. And she noticed that hydrogen just seemed to swamp everything else. It was a million times more prevalent than other things. And other astronomers thought that sounded way off. And she was advised not to make too big a fuss about this finding. And so in her dissertation, she reported what she found, but she said it was probably a spurious result. But having called attention to it, now other people really looked at this situation and did further analysis. And it took only 4 years for everyone to become convinced that it really was mostly hydrogen and helium. So sometimes the women, the way they were photographed, say in a line of paper dolls, gave the impression that maybe they weren't taken seriously or treated well. But I think they really were. Pickering, Shapley always credited them for what they did and put them up for prizes. They were members of the American Astronomical Society, even foreign astronomical societies as honorary members. They weren't paid as well as the men, but we have a lot of that going on even now. So Annie Jump Cannon was world famous, very well loved, and she was featured in the Wonder Woman comic books within just a few years of her death as a real-life Wonder Woman. She is on a modern website now called Rejected Princesses, women who are too awesome, awful, or offbeat to be featured in a kid's movie. And she is one of those. Also, I'm sure you remember Carl Sagan. He was very important in my life. He was the person who made me concentrate in astronomy. And recently his Cosmos television series was redone by the original writers with a new host. And there was an episode devoted to the Harvard women. It was called Sisters of the Sun. And that has inspired a couple of new plays. There'll be a web series about them called Insignificant. They have also made it into Lego figures and Lego figures on T-shirts with Miss Leavitt looking at the plates and Miss Cannon with her stellar classification and Miss Payne with her hydrogen and helium prevalence in the stars. And here's inspiration. This is a young artist, Leah Halloran, who's actually here tonight. You want to wave, Leah? Okay. Who has become fascinated by these women and the work they did. And she has actually painted some of the plates and used them in her unique cyano photo process, where she actually has sunlight. She uses her paintings as a negative and with sunlight creates these beautiful large-scale images, which are about 6 feet by 6 feet. And this is part of an exhibition that will open next spring that's called Your Body is the Space That Sees. There's still lots of work to be done at Harvard, lots of material there. Anybody interested in volunteering on the crowdsourcing platform, speak to me later. I'm going to be doing some of that myself. And just one final picture of the group. I think in the light of current events and the anti-science bias that is abroad in the land, it's very important to tell true stories about science. And I have never felt more strongly about that than I do now. Thank you.
It's so good to hear what you curate as the important facets of this story, because there are so many elements in it. And from reading the book, there's a depth to each story that goes well beyond, obviously, what you could discuss in your remarks. But a couple of questions. What does the title mean to you?
Well, the title is The Plate Collection. So the Harvard still has these plates. There are 500,000 of them. And it is a glass universe. And the plates are now being digitized with funding from the National Science Foundation, because the information content has never been fully probed. So, and scientists have always come to Harvard to look at this unique resource. But once they're digitized, people will be able to use them anywhere without fear of breaking them. And of course, the universe makes a kind of ceiling over us all, but there is the idea of the glass ceiling and the women doing work that was not quite the same as what the men were doing.
You mentioned the difference in pay that they received, and I just wanted to read a quick passage because I loved this. It just seems like this could have been written much more recently. And this was from Wilhelmina Fleming's journal. She said, "Sometimes I feel tempted to give up and let Professor Pickering try someone else or some of the men get some of the men to do my work, in order for him to find out what he is getting for $1,500 a year from me, compared with $2,500 from some of the other male assistants. Does he ever think that I have a home to keep and a family to take care of as well as the men? But I suppose a woman has no claim to such comforts, and this is considered an enlightened age."
Harumph. And she was raising her son while working 6 days a week at the observatory. And she put him through MIT, and he became a mining engineer.
I love that in that there's also, you know, this could have been from O Magazine, like work-life balance.
Yes, right.
You know, it's as much about the money as trying to figure it out. And often, you know, this is shift work. Often they were also going back at night at times, correct?
Oh, yes. Miss Cannon often went back at night to do her observations, which she couldn't do in the daytime.
To what do you attribute Pickering's progressive thinking?
I think he was an unusual person. I think he'd had a very good start in life. He came from a well-to-do family. He was extremely well-educated, and he was well-married and happily married and had no children, but really believed in opportunities for women and was an outspoken proponent of higher education for women at a time when people thought college was bad for girls. That going to college would actually negatively influence a woman's ability to bear children. No, I'm serious. So not only was he hiring women to work in the observatory, but then he put out a call for women who had been to college, who owned a telescope, to do useful work as volunteers. So he would give them specific observations that needed to be made, and that they could do that and submit their observations to Harvard and get them published and participate in the work. And he felt that way we could prove that women are making useful contributions to science.
There's a strong element of altruism and progressive thinking in what you just described, but there's also some real economics in here.
Absolutely. He could get all that work done for free.
Free, less. Also, the donors. How important was it that women gave money to employ, and ultimately there were prizes for women astronomers? How important was that line of money from women to women?
Oh, the money was crucial. But whether it came from a woman or a man at first might not have mattered. But it is interesting that so much of it did come from women. So there was Mrs. Draper's money, and then Catherine Wolfe Bruce, and then Lydia Mitchell Hinchman, who was a cousin of Mariah Mitchell's. And she set up a program for a young woman to work at Harvard and then be on Nantucket, where Mariah Mitchell had lived, and teach astronomy to the local people and use Miss Mariah Mitchell's telescope to let people look at the stars. And that was so successful that the first woman in that job got hired as the permanent director of the Nantucket Mariah Mitchell Observatory. So then Mrs. Hinchman thought, well, let's endow another fellowship. Let's have another one so more young women get this chance. And her money was specifically for women. And that was the fund that wound up being the money for graduate students. So that was really crucial in getting the early master's and doctoral degrees for women.
When you started writing this book, did you ever imagine that simultaneous to its release would be a major motion picture about women astronomers at the same time in theaters? And I'm talking about Hidden Figures
Hidden Figures.
Those who haven't seen the billboards everywhere. But is there some sort of kismet here?
It's bizarre that my book is the third book this year about women who were called computers. So first was Rise of the Rocket Girls by Natalia Holt, and then Hidden Figures by Margot Lee Shetterly, which is the movie to be, and now my book. But the women in those stories really were computers. They were completely doing math, whereas I feel my ladies started as computers but then became astronomers. And actually, probably opened the way for so many other women to be computers later, because this story starts in the 1880s. The Hidden Figures is 1950s mostly, Rise of the Rocket Girls 50s and 60s. So the presence of the Harvard women and the diaspora of the Harvard fellowships to observatories all over the country really put women in place to do astronomy.
You know, the subject matter of what these computers did was astronomy, but the work was really math, algorithmic, cataloging, much of what we would consider modern-day computer science. And I think I wonder what your perception of the emphasis on women in the STEM careers, science, technology, and maths, and engineering. Do you think that this interest, the three books, the movie, that it's a sign that that groundswell is actually taking purchase and moving forward and encouraging more young women to be involved in the sciences?
I do.
The hard sciences.
Well, we can hope that it is, yeah. I think so. I'd like to see it more.
Is there a cool factor that makes that more appealing? Is it just breaking up, creating a picture that young women can see? Is it the practical, that those are where the jobs will be? What do you see as making this something that will find a future with women more?
Well, this is not my area of expertise, but I do feel that women have not had a lot of examples before. And this story has really not been widely known. Astronomers know the story, but it's not widely known. I recently spoke to a woman who was a 1981 graduate of Harvard in a women's studies program, and she said, I never heard of this group of women. So even at Harvard, so I felt it's a story that needs to come out now, not because the women weren't appreciated in their day, not because they didn't get credit and now they should, but because the story's been forgotten and it's exemplary. And when I was in high school, I took a city exam to go to the Bronx High School of Science. So this was in the early 60s, very early 60s. And we were told at the exam that boys would be admitted preferentially over girls in a ratio of about 4-1. And nobody thought that was odd or unusual at that time. It was just the way things were. And now at a public school, you couldn't do that. And I went back recently to speak at commencement, and it was about 50-50. So things do change. And you often hear that girls who are good at math reach an age, maybe early teens, when all of a sudden they don't want to be good at math anymore. And I don't know what that's about, but maybe having examples is part of it.
More examples, more framework, more...
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I think even just a script to know. I have a friend who's a... she's got a master's degree from Stanford in math, and she tells people that what she does for a living is modeling. I'm modeling mathematics, math models. you went to the Bronx Science for High School, a really well-known school for science. Mm-hmm. And what spoke to you when you were in high school?
I don't think I could see myself as a scientist then. I was really interested in science. I loved being at that school. My mother was a chemist, so I had a model at home of a woman who was really interested in science, and that was okay. But I really liked to write, and the teachers in high school who had the most influence on me were English teachers. And you would think somebody would have said to me, you could write about science. But that never occurred to me. It was never suggested to me. And so my college career was just abysmal, changing majors, changing schools, never being able to see what to do with these two interests. And it's only by great good luck that I fell into a newspaper job, and it happened to be the year of the first Earth Day. So I got to write about science. And even then, I think it was another 6 months before I ever heard the term science writing.
What were some of those early stories that you really connected with that made you think, yeah, this is what I, you know, you're kind of, when you start out, you're looking for a beat, really. I mean, you were on the women's pages.
I was on the women's pages, right? Which meant I could write about whatever I wanted, really. So there was conservation, pollution, and I was very interested in genetic counseling, which was a new field. So those areas. And then it was from there that I went to the public lecture given by Carl Sagan and found that really a life-changing experience.
What were some of the bread and butter stories that you would cover, like when you were at the New York Times and writing there about science, that really were the things that were your really what you were focusing on?
Well, when I applied for my job at the New York Times, it was for a general assignment reporter with an emphasis on technology. Over the 6 or 8 weeks of the various interviews, at the last minute, the top person said, "What this paper really needs is someone to cover psychiatry and psychology. Are you willing to do that?" Well, sure. But I had exactly one college-level course in psychology, and it was horribly stressful to be doing that work, to be so ill-prepared. But I say this to all the young people, life is just one long experience in on-the-job education, you know, it's just on-the-job training. So I learned a lot, I was constantly studying, and then I got to do really interesting things. So they volunteered me for a stint in a laboratory that was studying circadian rhythm, so I had to live for a month without knowing what time it was. That was a lot of fun. Then I got volunteered to work at a mental hospital where the age of the patient pretty much dictated what had happened to that person in treatment. This was a state hospital, so they were people with really serious problems.
How did you transition into science from there?
Well, that was science. That was the Science Times in its infancy. And actually, they called the beat human behavior. So one time, another reporter asked me what my beat was, and I said human behavior. He said, "That's ridiculous. Every reporter covers human behavior. What do you do, really?" So, but it was really psychiatry and psychology. And I wrote about the new diagnostic and statistical manual when it came out, or new theories about different syndromes. There was always something to do.
What's the geekiest thing you've written about?
The geekiest thing. Oh, probably the space station, or going to space camp. That might have been the geekiest. Yeah. Yeah. I got to go to space camp. That's really fun. I don't know if they still do it. This is some years ago. But it was a week-long program where you get to wear a flight suit the whole week. I mean, that alone was worth... and you have to fly a mission on the space shuttle. And it's a simulated 24-hour mission. But when you're doing it, it feels real. So the week is training. We studied the manuals. We had lectures. We really learned about the space shuttle. And on this mission, we had to launch a communication satellite and then while you're on the mission, the people who run the program are throwing different problems at you. Things go wrong, and you have to solve them. And you really sweat. It's very nerve-wracking. But it was great. And I there's a shuttle crew and a grounds crew, and I got to be the capsule communicator. So I got to say, Enterprise, this is Houston. And I thought, this is the pinnacle after.
I remember early in my career doing TV around technology, I had to do a story about nanophotolithography, and I was about 2 hours into the research, and just my head hurt, and I was so nervous that I wasn't going to be able to make a TV story about this. Do you have those moments?
Yes, I have them all the time. Even this story, this book, there is so much science happened from the beginning of the story to the end of the story. That I had many of those moments saying, whatever made me think I could do this? But you get through it.
Do you think that I have boy-girl twins, and I watch them do their math homework, and I see my daughter sometimes get into the middle of that problem and get intimidated by the scope of it and think, I'm not smart enough to do this. And my son has a more intrinsic reaction of, this problem's too hard. Do you ever find in your, when you're in deep in something really dense, that you turn it on yourself and have to get the mirror off yourself and just plow through it?
Yeah, I think and I don't know if that's being female or something else in my personality, but I think a lot of women absorb a lot of misogyny without even being aware of it. One of the most interesting outcomes of this book, I gave the manuscript to about 10 people to read as technical experts. And one of them was a woman who's a full professor of astronomy at Harvard. And her reaction was so interesting. I mean, there she is at Harvard. And she, I'd heard about these women, I knew this went on, but I always thought it was something cute or quaint that they weren't really doing science. And so she was amazed to read that they were actually doing science, and she completely dropped the ball on being a technical expert. But she said, you've got to come up here and teach us our history. So she arranged to have the launch event for the book at the Harvard Observatory, which was really a thrill. Now, this same person, Miss Cannon, we spoke about earlier, became world famous for the work she did. And she got various honorary degrees and prizes. And she took one of her prizes, which was $1,000, and she endowed the Annie Jump Cannon Prize, which was for a woman astronomer. This same faculty member at Harvard was put up for that prize. And her reaction was, I don't want any prize that's just for a woman. So Miss Cannon's idea was, women need encouragement. I'm going to make this prize. And that prize is now offered every year. So every year, and the money's grown, and other money's been put into it, so it's about $1,500 now, and it's every year instead of every 3 years, the way she set it up. So is that what's necessary, or should the prize be changed and just be for an astronomer so that women who receive it feel that it's more of a distinction? These are deep furrows around the story that I'm really interested in. We'll see what happens.
The end of your presentation segued into, I think, a larger discussion as well, and I'll phrase it this way. Where has science writing succeeded?
Well, for a long time, lots of newspapers had science sections, and those have been disappearing, because newspapers have been changing. And things are about to change a lot more. I think science writing has succeeded in creating a better informed public. But again, this is something I'm not really taking the pulse of the general population. So I don't know that I can say in an authoritative way where it has succeeded. I just think there's a value to it, and the more that news is sensationalized, the more that the process of science is not understood, the more that doubt is spread, the more I see a need for better science education, better understanding of what it means to say something is a theory. It's not just somebody's half-baked idea, you know, if it's a theory. It has more to it than that.
The image of the two ants looking at the solar system and saying makes you feel small. There's something for many people, and I have occasionally fallen into this category, that when I think of science, I go beyond feeling small. I feel somewhat, not science, more astronomy and space. It's almost dystopian to me sometimes. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because we just have so many movies about, and Elon Musk saying that we're going to colonize Mars, that I'm not ready to give up on this planet, and I sort of shut down a little bit. What do you say to people who are a little bit space phobic?
People don't usually say that to me.
I have the protection of this community.
some people find astronomy terrifying. Just the concept of space, terrifying. Some people are afraid of the dark.
Well, how do you manage the being the ant?
I don't find it terrifying. I mean, we are a product of this universe. So we belong here. We're smaller than other things, but there are other smaller things inside us. I don't know, I'm strangely comfortable with it. Maybe it was having a mother who was a chemist.
Where do you feel that, as we're really looking, you know, post-truth, climate deniers, what has to change with the way that we talk to everyone about science and what's happening in our world?
I wish I knew. I really wish I knew, but I don't know. And the more people have just the news they want, the fewer avenues there seem to be for information, education. That's a big question.
How do you've done really masterful work tying narrative, science, history, and emotion. How do you do that? It's a big, huge question, but do you have a formula? Do you find a story that has pieces of all those things? What?
No. The way all these books have happened, each one has just been about hearing something that really struck me, like Henrietta Swan Leavitt made a discovery that made it possible to measure distance in space. It's something like that that just is electrifying. And I just want to know that story and tell it. Or Galileo's Daughter. I'll never forget working on longitude and just reading about Galileo's work on the longitude problem and finding out that he had two daughters who were nuns. That was just so shocking to me. This person who I'd been taught was the enemy of the church. And it just instantly made me feel that everything I'd been taught about Galileo was probably wrong. And what if he did everything he did as a believing Catholic? Isn't that an interesting, much more interesting story? So it's something like that. It's something unexpected that surprises me. And then I go to find out about it, And then the story just gets more and more interesting. And then it's like falling in love. It's something that's just so compelling that, you know, whatever it takes to be able to tell that story, that's what I want to do.
You've taught, and so much of what you do in your work is teaching. How do you foster that curiosity directly?
How do I foster curiosity?
That curiosity that you're talking about, that willingness to go a mile deep.
I'm not sure I know how to foster it in other people. Fortunately, a lot of people really have those feelings. People are curious, open, interested in the world, which is great. If they're not, try to poke them. there's so much to be interested in.
Do you ever come across people whose beliefs are so, who are anti-scientific in their beliefs, besides me and my space phobia? But have you ever come across someone who's a climate denier and had to have that conversation with them, and how do you do it?
I haven't really had the conversation. I don't tend to get involved in debate. You know, writers mostly sit alone in a room, which is really where I'm most comfortable.
You're doing great.
So I don't. I would not be good having a confrontation with a client denier. I know I would fail miserably at that.
This is a question from the audience. Thank you for your devotion to writing about women in science. And the question, do you think artificial intelligence will replace existing scientific careers? And if so, what will people be needed for?
Another thing, this is what I mean about on-the-job training. I personally do not think that artificial intelligence will replace scientists' curiosity. But that is only my opinion. I think artificial intelligence will do a lot of computing work.
Is there a story you've wanted to tell but thought, I don't know if I can make this into a compelling story, but I like
this one.
This one.
Yeah, because there were so many characters. And it was a real question at the beginning whether it would work or whether I needed to find one of the women to carry the story and just mention the others. And it took about a year back and forth wondering about that. But then I just felt that the timeline, that they just all had to be in it, because they take turns carrying the story. And then I felt that the plates themselves were a character, and that's also a unifying thread. But as I said, there's a lot of science. It's a long period of time, and there are a lot of people. But I'm pleased with the way it turned out, and that feels good.
This is another audience question. There's a couple here that I'll sort of consolidate into one. What other stories of women in science, mathematics, computing do you know of that you're interested in? And one mentions World War II code breaking. Anything that is one of those sleeper stories that you're interested in, that we should be interested in?
I don't know of others. The Harvard women during World War II were all working for the war effort. Mrs. Shapley worked for the Navy doing ballistics trajectories. Some of the women taught celestial navigation. There was all kinds of work to be done. I think the Bletchley Park women have, their story has been told quite a bit and even dramatized. Ada Lovelace's story has been told. Sometimes stories can be told again, and but I don't. There isn't one that I'm I don't feel I'm finished with these women. As I said, more material turns up at Harvard all the time, and there's so much interest in them that I would just like to revel in for a while, even just using the research I've done to help other people with their projects. I just want to see the story roll. And it's fun when people do other things with it. I just found out yesterday in Philadelphia there was an opera about Annie Jump Cannon. It was called Jump the Moon, or I'm sorry, I've forgotten the title. And it, you know, played briefly in Philadelphia, and then did any of you ever hear of it? I never heard of it. So it's a beautiful thing when people work on a particular subject but approach it through a different medium, different music or art, or anything could happen.
This is the last question, and I love that you called out the artist who's here with the glass plate paintings. And for those who are listening, there are two young people right in the front
yep.
seat, very impressed that they came. And what would your advice be to young people, to people who are trying to find their way to connect with what may have been unapproachable, in at least historically, for women? But really, this is genderless. You know, pursuing science is so important. What's your advice?
I'll tell you what I told my own children. And the occasion was the television version of Galileo's Daughter was up for an Emmy, and the producers overlooked me on the invitation list to the ceremony, which I found really funny, and I was with my son when this happened, and we won also. So they called me the day of the event. Are you in New York? Do you have a dress? No. So I said, let this be a lesson that whatever you do in life, that it's something you enjoy in the small moments of the day, because now you've seen when it comes time for the big celebration, they could forget to invite you.
Very good advice. With that, we will end this edition of the Commonwealth Club of California. We've been talking to Dava Sobel, former New York Times science reporter and author of several books, including her latest, The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. I'm Becky Worley, your moderator. You can listen to the Commonwealth Club programs on our radio or our podcast. Watch our YouTube channel, check out our website, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter.